anti-pollution programs around the Mississippi River are having a tough time getting the job done. They're not addressing a growing problem with water pollution. Studies tell us this. Environmental groups are well aware. We're looking at partnerships and policies that are cropping up around an effort to decrease nutrient pollution in the Great River that rises from Lake Itasca in Minnesota and flows southward to the Gulf of Mexico. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Jamie Konopacki is an attorney and watershed policy specialist who facilitates partnerships that aim to decrease nutrient pollution. She's worked with the City of Green Bay. She was a fellow at Harvard Law School's Environmental Policy Initiative, where she helped the U.S. Senate Agriculture Committee revise conservation planning in the most recent farm bill. Jamie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So help us with some context here. Have we always had nutrient pollution in our river, or has it really increased over time? What do the trend lines tell us?
So I think we've always had nutrient pollution, nutrient runoff. Nutrients come from municipal sewage treatment plants. They also come from agriculture. And I think a lot of people are acutely aware of agriculture and some of the increasing size of farms that we've been seeing over the years. And that certainly means an increased amount of nutrients on the land. And even in the best cases and on the best managed farms, rainfall is still going to carry nutrients. So it's always been a challenge, but as city populations grow and as farms grow.
So we have the sewage treatment plants, we have the agricultural runoff, stormwater. How does residential and commercial development fit into the pollution issue?
So we have kind of three or four main categories of players or sources of nutrient pollution. We have the runoff from farms, and we have the runoff from municipal areas, and we also have the discharges from municipal treatment plants. So as cities get larger and we have more yards and more paved areas, we have greater runoff from those areas.
And if you decrease wetlands, if you fill wetlands, that has an impact as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Wetlands can act as sinks for nitrogen and phosphorus. They can essentially hold those nutrients there and prevent them from reaching rivers and lakes. They're used as conservation tools in the Midwest. And so certainly they can help capture those nutrients. And when you get rid of them, you lose those sources of capture.
What happens when the nutrient levels get too high if nutrient pollution goes unchecked?
So then you have things, drinking water problems. So you have nitrate in drinking water, specifically above 10 milligrams per liter, which causes some really grave public health concerns. The thing that people are most familiar with is blue baby syndrome, which can cause, in the most severe cases, the death of infants. When you have nutrient surges in lakes and rivers, you have algae blooms, sometimes toxic algae blooms with neurotoxins.
And that's when you get those dead zones.
Absolutely.
In the Gulf,
mm-hmm.
Which now the dead zone is about the size of New Jersey.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
Huge.
Huge, yeah.
Yeah, and so where are you seeing movement? What have or what can governments do to clean up water? Where do you see movement?
So there's great movement, and I take issue with the idea that we're not doing anything to address the problem. We're not doing enough. I think we need to scale up some of the successes that we're seeing at the local level and at the state level and at the federal level, and better integrate our efforts. So throughout the Mississippi River Basin, states are developing and implementing what are called nutrient reduction strategies. Wisconsin developed its nutrient reduction strategy in 2013 and released an update progress report to that strategy in 2017. And that document kind of outlines a lot of great efforts that are ongoing in Wisconsin to address nutrients, voluntary efforts, regulatory efforts, and how those efforts, and they're really existing programs that we've been working with for a long time, but how efforts within those programs have been ramped up and integrated to try and meet the scale of the threat that we now face.
When I think of nutrients, I naturally think of farm runoff.
Yep.
I don't think of my own pollution that I'm contributing. I'm thinking of farmers and what they're putting on their fields. Have we seen, you know, businesses and farms work together on different strategies with their crops and when they apply things to their crops?
Yeah, I think farmers are making a good effort in a lot of places. I think some of the most exciting kind of collaborative efforts with farmers are what I like to call municipal agricultural partnerships. So one of the most prominent of those partnerships in Wisconsin is in the Rock River watershed and in the Ahara sub-watershed. So right here in Madison, you have Madison Metropolitan Sewerage District, and I think 23 or 24 municipal partners and state partners and federal partners working with farmers to reduce nutrient pollution in the watershed. And it's a really successful and exciting effort, and it's something that the federal EPA is looking to spread across the country.
Talking with Jamie Konopacki, she's an attorney and watershed policy specialist. We're looking at nutrient runoff in the Mississippi River and what cities and communities are doing about it, where it comes from. What is your story about the Mississippi River? Do you live along the river? Are you concerned about runoff? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jamie, when I think of the Mississippi River, I often think of my time in Baton Rouge and looking at the mouth of the Mississippi, and you can go up and look at the Mississippi River at the levee in Baton Rouge, and I'm always so apologetic to the Mississippi because at that point, it's all refineries right along the banks. There is a lot of port action, and it's all about oil refining. Mm-hmm. And I don't see what the river has actually had to deal with further up, that there is a lot of nutrients in the water and there's been all of this other stuff going on before it finally gets to the mouth, and now it's got to deal with with oil refinery. I mean, this river is resilient.
It is resilient. I mean, it's the largest watershed in the U.S. It's draining parts or all of, I think, 31 or 32 states. It's massive. So it's absorbing a lot, but nature is strong, powerful, resilient, like you're saying. So it's put up with a lot. But what we can see is that there's a breaking point for everything. And the dead zone in the Gulf, it's just the same thing that we're seeing in Wisconsin and Iowa and states throughout the Midwest. You know, we see the same algae blooms and pollutions. There is a breaking point in nature eventually, and it's harder to tell when you're working with such a large system, but we have a pretty good indicator that we need to do better upstream.
10 years ago, the EPA tasked states along the Mississippi to cut pollution by 45% in hopes of dealing with the dead zone in the Gulf. And an investigation recently by the Iowa Gazette found out that progress is minimal. What did you think about that study?
So it was a pretty high-level look at the nutrient reduction strategies, and that's what I was referring to earlier. I think that there has been success. It's really hard to read those documents without a really solid understanding of the underlying programs that the states are using. So in Wisconsin, to implement our nutrient reduction strategy, we're using things like total maximum daily loads, which people are somewhat familiar with. They're kind of pollution diets for water bodies. We're using Section 319 plans, which are a different type of watershed plan where you're working with agricultural producers to identify measurable milestones and reduce pollution in smaller areas. We're using permits for municipal wastewater treatment plants and also municipal stormwater areas. And all of those programs are slowly chipping away at this problem. But I think it's going to require a lot more funding, integration of effort to get to where we need to go. So I think there is progress, but it's the devil's in the details.
Attorney and watershed policy consultant Jamie Konopacki stays with us. Your insights are welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you live along the Mississippi River? Have you seen the environment change over the years? If you're a farmer, what steps do you take to limit runoff? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation, perhaps hear from you in just a minute on the Ideas Network. Nitrate and phosphorus from industry and agriculture have created a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. It's this area of low oxygen that can kill fish and marine life. It's about the size of New Jersey. And there are researchers all over the place who are working to try to reverse the harmful effects of this water pollution. with better nutrient management and tillage and use of cover crops. We're looking at next steps and what options are on the table. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Attorney Jamie Konopacki is a watershed policy specialist. We're gathering your insights and your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. What concerns do you have about water quality in Wisconsin? How should it be measured and regulated? You can call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jamie, let's go back for just a moment here and create a really good understanding of the difference between nitrogen and phosphorus.
Sure. So when it comes to growing crops, they're both vitally important nutrients for crops. They help, you know, strong stems, good leaves, strong roots. The main difference is kind of how they behave in water. And what scientists have told us is that when we're looking at what is the potential for water pollution, we need to look at what is the limiting nutrient in a water body. And when you look at inland lakes and rivers, like in Wisconsin, in those surface water systems, phosphorus is generally the limiting nutrient. And down in the Gulf, we're talking about nitrogen being the limiting nutrient. Another important distinction is that phosphorus pollution usually binds to soil and is carried off into surface waters. There is also a soluble component, but there's a strong insoluble component of phosphorus, so it's going across the surface. And nitrate is really water soluble, so it becomes a groundwater issue. It leaches through especially the porous sandy soils we have in the center of the state, and certainly through the bedrock cracks that we have kind of in a V along the edges and the bottom of the state here in Wisconsin. So
which should we be more concerned about at this point?
Both. Unfortunately, both. You can't, you definitely can't pick one or the other. The surface water blooms are, you know, increasingly of growing concern, in particular because of those cyanotoxins that I was talking about earlier. We know very little about a whole bunch of these scary neurotoxins that can pop up in those surface water blooms that are caused by phosphorus. And nitrate is a huge issue in this state. We just saw, you know, a well study in the Southwest, and unfortunately one infant has, you know, already died because of nitrate pollution in our groundwater here. I think in 2017, I think we had about 50 community wells that were over the standard for nitrate. It's scary.
So let's look at possible solutions here. What is the role of the EPA in all of this?
So at the federal level, I think both the EPA and the USDA are incredibly important. So we have a whole bunch of federal, state, and local programs that all have to work together to address the issue. EPA can do important technical support for modeling and developing of models, for instance. They can provide essential support at also to the states. And states do a lot of working on monitoring, modeling, and support at the local level. USDA is also really important entity to look at. So USDA and NRCS are responsible for implementing the conservation programs in the Farm Bill. And there is a lot of dollars and technical expertise housed in that agency as well. That's critical. At the state level here, we provide a lot of dollars through state programs for working with farmers on conservation. But we also rely a lot on those federal programs. So we need to make sure that they're working together in the most efficient way possible to address the challenges as quickly as possible.
And a challenge in one place of the watershed may be different than another place. It seems like there are so many different issues going on and not one size fits all.
Absolutely. There's not one size fits all, but there is, I think, a general framework that we can take from watershed to watershed. So through the 319 program, for instance, that's a program under the Clean Water Act that specifically aims at helping address non-point pollution. They've established a framework for watershed planning, and so it's essentially things like, let's look at the land base that we're working with, try to identify the sources of contamination, try to identify what's the total load in terms of pounds or tons of phosphorus or sediment that we're seeing. Let's identify measurable milestones and then have a plan for education and outreach and tracking and monitoring. So you can take that type of plan and then tools for mapping out conservation practices in a watershed, and you can put them together and you can come up with an idea of how much funding and how many people you're going to need on the ground in a small local watershed to address a problem. And my theory is that it's really important to concentrate on these local planning efforts and balance the planning with the implementation. We don't want to just develop more plans that sit on the shelf. So definitely different, but I think we have a common framework for analysis and identifying what the priorities should be.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Brian joining us from Rochester, Minnesota. Brian, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just wondering, as consumers, what we can do differently. Anything we can we change our purchasing habits, for example, to help out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that there, for a long time, have been entities, big food producers, stores that are looking through the supply chain to encourage agricultural producers to use better practices. We've seen that for a long time with water quantity, Coca-Cola doing a lot of work to message that they're a company that's looking to reduce their water usage, so you should buy their product over maybe Pepsi because they're doing water quantity efforts. That's newer and evolving in water quality. So hopefully someday we get to the point where we have, green stars or green corn cobs, on products that are produced from areas where there are practices, sustainable practices on the ground. We haven't seen, I don't think, enough of that yet to, as consumers point to one product versus the other. But I think as local citizens, getting involved with the water protection planning for your local source of your local public water supply is a really important thing that folks can do.
So a recent study found that 42% of private wells in southwest Wisconsin are contaminated, exceeding acceptable limits of bacteria or nitrates.
Mm-hmm.
So what is going on there, and what type of action needs to take place to reverse that?
Yeah, so we have an interesting karst topography that kind of makes a V shape around the state of Wisconsin. And so we also saw some new targeted rules along the eastern part of the state because it has the same type of vulnerable bedrock structure. Essentially, cracks in this bedrock create super highways where if you have manure, the bacteria and the nitrates from manure and the fertilizer can go right down to the groundwater table, which is, of course, where our public wells are. So that's what we have going on. It's nitrates filtering down through some pretty permeable underlying bedrock. And contaminating water supplies.
And so are there specific plans to address that? Because these are private wells, private citizens,
yeah.
Their own wells on their own property.
Well, and they're private wells and public wells. Like I said earlier, I think in 2017 we had 50 public water supplies attested above. So it's really challenging because the onus is on you if you have a private well to be testing your well. And I had a private well growing up. I know we didn't test our well. Representative Voss has said that he plans to commence a task force on the issue. I think the incoming administration has expressed a lot of support for ramping up science efforts and funding at the
incoming DNR. Governor Tony Evers.
Correct. Yeah.
Administration.
Yeah.
So do you see glimpses of hope there in terms of the funding you need in order to bring these programs to fruition?
Glimpses, yes, but I think concerned citizens need to hold elected representatives and Tony Evers' new administration hold the feet to the fire because it's reaching catastrophic proportions in Wisconsin. And I think that the pollution has been on the uptick for a while now, but these studies really make clear that we've got a big and serious problem.
Wisconsin is known for its agriculture. It has dairy. It has CAFOs. How have farmers here adapted to water policies and practices? Is Wisconsin taking a lead?
Yeah, I think Wisconsin is still taking a lead. CAFOs are managed differently in Wisconsin and across the country under the Clean Water Act than smaller operations. So CAFOs, by definition, are about 1,000 animal units or more, and they have permits just like municipal sewage treatment plants have permits under the Clean Water Act. In those permits, they're required to do nutrient management planning to identify the land acres where they're going to spread manure. But it's really challenging. And as a result of Midwest Environmental Advocates' petition, I think back in 2015 to EPA, we had EPA come in and kind of do some investigations. So DNR got 4 new staff for that CAFO program because it's a lot of work. I think we now have around 300 CAFOs in the state. each of those operations, I think, if you look at the report from Wisconsin Land and Water here, they can have like 12 million gallons of manure each operation per year to spread. So they need like 2,000 acres. So making clear that there's sufficient acres where these operations can haul and spread that manure without having this threat that it's going to be spread in areas where it's going to penetrate down to the water table and contaminate. It's a big job. You know, we have to work together to do it. But yeah, I think that we have strong programs in the state, and we are continuing to try and lead.
In the last few seconds we have with you, if you could leave us with one thing we could do today to help improve water quality in the Mississippi River, what would it be?
I say just get involved and pick a way to get involved. If your primary concern is nitrate in your drinking water supply, then you can get involved with what's called source water assessment and protection planning in your community. Be aware of where your watershed is and what the threats to your surface and groundwater are, and be a part of the solution at the local level.
Jamie, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Jamie Konopacki is an attorney and watershed policy specialist who works on partnerships that decrease nutrient pollution. She's worked with the city of Green Bay, was a fellow at Harvard, where she worked with governments along the Eastern Seaboard and published on watershed solutions. Coming up next, winter does a number on our skin. We'll talk with a dermatologist about how to take care of it. Do you change the way you care for your skin in the winter? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Winter skin troubles a majority of Americans. And I say this after applying a liberal coating of lip balm just now. A new survey examining the winter ailments of 2,000 Americans saw 60% of respondents cite their skin as unhealthy in the winter, with 1 in 4 suffering regular itching. The winter struggle afflicts so many people that 64% are likely to seek professional help from a dermatologist in the winter, so we put out a line to one. Dr. Apple Bodemer is an assistant professor in the dermatology department at UW-Madison. She also directs an integrative dermatology clinic, which focuses on offering this healthcare approach for dermatologic conditions. Dr. Bodemer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So how does winter weather do a number on our skin? What is the impact?
Well, it's much drier in general, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that we're indoors with forced air heat. So even if it's pretty humid outside, like it is lately in the last couple weeks for Wisconsin, we go back inside. And so there's a difference when you're kind of shifting between hot and cold, and then either being very dry outside, which we're coming into now with this cold front, or even when it's moist inside, coming indoors to forced air heating.
Oh, so our skin doesn't really like those extremes, going from one to the other?
Yeah, that's hard on the skin to kind of make that adjustment, especially when we're doing it multiple times, and then sort of adjusting to the different levels of humidity.
So what are the symptoms when our skin dehydrates due to this going back and forth and the air quality?
Well, you named it earlier. It's itching. The most common cause of itching is dry skin. And that's something I see so much of. We also don't deal with it as well as we get older. So our skin is much more resilient as younger kids and younger adults. And then as we get closer to kind of middle age and upper ages, it's harder for our skin to maintain moisture. And so, you know, I'll see people with really dry skin, and I always comment on it in my clinics. I'll say, you know, it doesn't bother me if it doesn't bother you. But if you get itchy, the first thing to do is to moisturize.
Okay, so moisturize, what do you mean by that, and how do you go about doing that? Where do you start?
Yeah, so it's very important to there's kind of first place to start is really limiting exposure to hot water. We think of water and especially steamy showers and baths as being really good for our skin because we get out of the, you know, we get out and it feels like a nice humid environment. But actually what that heat in particular is doing is is causing the little tiny capillaries, which are the little blood vessels close to the surface of the skin, to open up and dilate, and that allows for us to lose more moisture from our skin. So when we get out of that steamy bath or shower, we're wiping off all of the moisture that's come from kind of our circulation to the surface of the skin, and we're wiping it off with our towels. So actually those steamy hot showers, which feel so good this time of year, are actually causing us to causing more dryness in the long run. And so just limiting your exposure. So no more than 5 minute showers or baths, 10 minutes max, making sure that you're using what we call a moisturizer right after you get out of the bath or shower. And when I say we call it a moisturizer, because it is, most of the things that we put on our skin don't actually add moisture to our skin. They actually help lock moisture in, and we call those occlusives. There are a few ingredients that you can look for that will help keep draw moisture to the skin, but it's really drawing it from our circulation. So we have this combination of some things that will help keep moisture in the skin and then locking it in. And really the only time that we actually draw from the environment is with an ambient humidity of like 70%. So that's like in the rainforest. Otherwise, what we're really trying to do is manage kind of the hydration of our skin from our circulation. So that's also really...
No rainforests around here. Sorry.
Right, no rainforests around here. but that also brings me to oral hydration. And we have very few studies actually looking at the impact oral hydration has on overall day-to-day skin health. But from what I've seen in my clinic over the last 15-plus years is that it definitely makes a difference.
Oh, just drinking more water helps?
Making sure you're taking in enough non-caffeinated beverages will help, because that's where our skin hydration primarily comes from, is from our circulation. So if you're kind of depleted and dehydrated, it's not going to make its way as efficiently to the skin.
Talking with Dr. Apple Bodemer, who is an integrative dermatologist and an assistant professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. Getting your questions as well about your skin in the winter, 800-642-1234. What do you do to keep your skin moisturized during winter? Do you have dry hands because of your job? Farmers, restaurant workers, medical professionals, construction workers, how do you keep your hands and skin from getting too dry in the winter? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Bodemer, in the winter especially, we have flu around us. We have lots of sneezing going on. And so it seems like we tend to want to wash our hands a lot. We need to wash our hands regularly for proper hygiene. But then your hands just get so raw. What do you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a couple of tricks with that. One is, and I didn't mention earlier, but making sure that you're using your moisturizer on the skin while it's still a little bit damp. That's going to help lock moisture in. So when you are washing your hands multiple times, having a thick cream or ointment with you so that you can put that on right after you're done washing to help protect the skin. The other thing that I find, especially for people who are, washing multiple times a day or doing a lot of wet work like dishes or washing, is one thing you can do is use a layer of Vaseline before you go into that dirty work. So, put the Vaseline on before you do the dishes. That's going to help give you some protection. Or put the Vaseline on, before you go change that baby's diaper. So when you go wash your hands, you're taking off the Vaseline is going to keep, some of the germs and trap them. And so when you wash out that Vaseline, you're not going to have to get as aggressive with how you're washing your hands. But it can be really tricky. And, I work in an environment where we're using the alcohol gel all the time. In and out from each patient room and multiple times, even sometimes during visits. So it is tricky.
So we go to the store and we see a whole aisle of moisturizers and so many different products out there that are marketed to us that are, make all of these claims. As a consumer, what should we be looking for in a moisturizer?
Right, well, the first thing that I want to say is that lots of people reach for a lotion because they're easy and they don't leave any residue, but they're really a Band-Aid. So they don't work great for making sure that your skin can stay hydrated. You really want something thicker, a cream or an ointment. Ointments can be really greasy, so a lot of people don't like them during the day. So creams tend to be where most people find something that's usable and useful, for, especially for multiple daytime applications. So you want something that you can either squeeze out of a tube or scoop out of a tub. And, you know, there's a lot of things to look for. We all have different levels of comfort when it comes to the chemicals we're willing to put on our skin and price points. I would say there's a lot of really good sort of standard drugstore products that are inexpensive and very helpful. You want to try to stay away from dyes and from fragrances. And so that's something I look for on all the labels of my skincare products, because anytime there's a fragrance label, there's like a huge number of products that can be considered fragrance that can also function in other ways, and they don't have to list them out. So they might be using it as a preservative, but because it's also a fragrance, they can kind of put it in this umbrella and call it fragrance. So that's sort of a tricky term. If you see it on your on the ingredient list of your skincare products, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be something bad, but it does. It sort of is like kind of hides a lot of other things, and something that you're going to use regularly is really important. So how it smells and feels is something that you like. That also plays a big role, because you're going to use something you like rather than if I say this is what you should use and to you it feels tacky, you're not going to use that. There are several brands out there. I can throw out a handful. I don't like to necessarily pick one specific, mm-hmm. but ones that dermatologists that commonly recommend. Aveeno makes one that's got oatmeal in it, and oatmeal can be really soothing to dry, cracked, itchy skin. There's also Avalon Organics makes a similar product, so it sort of is the natural alternative to the Aveeno, which is a little bit more standard. So that's a good thing to look for. You're actually going to see that in an active ingredient list. So it'll be colloidal oatmeal. And that can be helpful. Anything that has got like beeswax in it or Vaseline or something that's kind of really makes it thicker is going to also be better.
So what happens when things really go south and your hands start to crack and bleed? What should be your first line of defense? What do you do?
Well, one thing that you can do is to really be aggressive with moisturizing. You can wash your hands while they're still damp, put on something either like Vaseline or a very heavy ointment, and then put some white cotton gloves over that at night to really keep that greasy ointment in place so that your hands can heal overnight. That's a really great trick. Sometimes you need a topical steroid if the inflammation is really bad, and that's something I see in the clinic all the time, and it's a medication that I use quite a lot because of the inflammation that gets started. Once your skin starts to break down and you get irritants kind of getting into the under the skin, causing more problems. So that might be something that you would need if it's impacting your daily activities. That's a time to check in with your primary doctor or your dermatologist.
We're talking with integrative dermatologist Apple Bodimer about how to take care of our largest organ during the winter months. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What skin challenges do you deal with during the winter? How do you keep your skin clean and well moisturized? Is it a struggle? Call in. You can tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. Winter skin problems are common, and we're talking about how to be kinder to skin these days. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to a recent Harris poll of 2,000 adults, 83% said their skin feels differently during the winter than it does the rest of the year. Integrative dermatologist Apple Bodemer stays with us to help us understand what we can do to keep our skin hydrated and alleviate the discomfort that comes with dry skin during the winter. Your questions, your strategies are welcome at 800-642-1234. How do you deal with dry skin? Are you into winter sports? How do you heal after a day outdoors that leaves your hands and face dry and chapped? And what questions do you have for the dermatologist? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Dr. Bodemer, let's look at skin and lips, because I'm sitting here talking to you with very chapped lips, and I know my kids get these really red, rashy lips, and their lips look enormous. What can we do to help our lips?
One of the things that we tend to do is lick them. When they start to get a little bit dry and feel uncomfortable and just a little bit scaly, we'll start licking them, and saliva is actually really irritating. So that's why some kids will get that huge rash all around the lips. We call it lick lickers dermatitis.
Oh, really?
So trying to not lick them when you start to notice that they're a little bit cracked and flaky is the first thing. And then certainly exactly what you're doing, just keep putting the lip balm on. You do want to be careful about the lip balm we're using. A lot of the standard products like the Vaseline Intensive Lip Care or a Carmex is sort of notorious for being a bad actor. Anything that has menthol or peppermint in it is potentially more irritating to the skin. And we actually see that in lip plumpers, which that's what they're basically trying to do, is irritate the lips so that they look more plump. So you want to make sure that you're using something really bland, something that's really like shea butter-based, coconut oil-based, or Vaseline-based. I love Vaseline a lot. I use it a lot. It's a large molecule. It doesn't really get absorbed very well into the skin, and almost nobody has a reaction to it. It's really great. Some of the Vaseline intensive care products they're not the same. So when I say Vaseline, I'm not meaning the whole sort of category. For people that do have concerns or don't want to be using petroleum byproducts, beeswax is really great, or the shea butter is really great. And so just something that's thick and heavy and try to minimize that lick-lipping. Lick-lipping. That's the tongue twister.
Hard to say. So does it take some time, though, for lips to heal, or just does it depend?
It depends. It depends partly on age. As I mentioned earlier, I believe that oral hydration plays a role, too. And then how diligent you are about keeping it covered. Some people, if it's really inflamed and you have deep cracks in the lips, that's going to be harder to heal. If there's yeast or bacteria present, even if they're not actually causing an infection, but we can see that a lot in sometimes in kids and older people who are drooling a lot. Sometimes you get yeast that comes from the oral cavity that can cause problems on the skin, especially around the lips, but including some irritation of the lips as well. It's less common. Usually it's really just irritation, and you don't necessarily need anti-yeast or antibacterial products for that, but that's something to watch for.
Travis called in and wanted to ask you, he says, my nose always gets red and flaky in the winter.
Yeah.
What can he do about it?
Yeah, the nose is tricky because a lot of us get cold, we're sneezing, blowing our nose a lot. And the tissues can be really, the paper can be really hard on the nose. That's a place where I love either my really thick, heavy shea-based, butter-based products or Vaseline. You know, a lot of people get cracking right at the top of the nose where the septum meets kind of what we call the nares or the outer part of the nostril. And that is a place where just being proactive. And if you're going to be outside and you know your nose is going to be exposed, keeping it covered with a thick ointment. The other part of that is minimizing exposure to the wind and the cold. And that's, you can, you know, wearing scarves or face masks. If you're going to be outdoors doing, being real active, those can be really helpful too in protecting, especially the face.
If someone is prone to acne or is fighting acne and is really focused on trying to keep that skin very clean, how do you manage acne in the winter months?
It's really pretty much the same as we'd manage in the summer months. We don't have to worry as much about sunscreen if you're not outdoors as much, which can be tricky for people with acne. But in the winter, the trick is making sure that it doesn't dry out. And but the oil gland's job is to produce enough oil to coat the skin in a protective layer. And when we over-dry that skin, either through just the environment that we're in or through the toners that get used, or a lot of the over-the-counter or prescription-based products tend to dry the skin out too, if we overdo it, we can actually send that message to the oil gland, hey, I need help. And that causes the oil gland to make more oil, which is exactly what we don't want. Acne really is a problem with oil under the skin. The oil on the surface is what most people focus on, and that's not really the main issue. So I find a lot of people kind of run into more trouble by under-moisturizing than over-moisturizing when it comes to acne. I've certainly had some patients who really do well, even using really very heavy moisturizers on the face. Depends a lot on your skin type, and I don't necessarily recommend everybody go out and put Vaseline on their face who has acne. But definitely making sure you're paying especially close attention to moisturizing, usually using a light moisturizer. There are some really good ones on the market that are really gentle on the skin and non-irritating. I really love food-grade oils as a moisturizer, and that kind of comes as part of my integrative package. People will hear me talking about food-grade oils a lot. And in particular for acne, apricot kernel oil and jojoba oil are the two lightest and tend to look the best for people who have skin that tends to be more oily.
You said the word sunscreen at the outset mm-hmm. there. First of all, do we need the sunscreen in the winter? And second of all, can we integrate moisturizer into the sunscreen?
Yeah, absolutely we do need sunscreen in the winter. We don't need to sunscreen as much of our body because we're not exposing as much of it usually, but especially if you're out there being active, regardless of whatever sport it is or activity it is, even just shoveling snow, the UV radiation reflects off of snow and ice pretty efficiently. And so even though you may not be getting it kind of from the head down, you're probably getting it from the ground up. So that's important. And certainly covering the face, again, those scarves and face masks and hats can be helpful, but any part of the skin that's exposed is at potential risk for sunburn. You know, and that's what we want to avoid is a bad sunburn. So skiing, snowboarding, especially on the warmer winter days where you might take off some of your layers of clothing, that's something just to think about.
Is it effective, though, for sunscreens to have moisturizer in them, and is that enough?
Yes. It depends on a lot. There's a lot of moisturizers out there that have an SPF factor in them. When you're going to be outdoor and active, like, for a prolonged period of time, I definitely would like to see an SPF of 30 or more. And so some of these moisturizers get to 15 or 20 and they don't get to kind of the level that I would like to see for somebody that's being active outdoors and at risk for sunburn. But there are certainly other ones on the market that do, and a lot of them combined. I mean, all sunscreens are going to have some moisturizing capabilities. And the trick gets to be how heavy is it and what part of the body is it going to be best used for. So a lot of the lighter moisturizers are more effective, well, not more effective, but easier to use on the face because they're not quite as heavy. I do like mineral-based sunscreens. Those are the physical barriers, and I generally ask people to look for those. They especially if you have sensitive skin, that's especially important because many of the chemicals that are used in sunscreens can be irritating to the skin. Not for everybody, but definitely for some people. And so, so as long as it's an SPF of 30 or more, whether it comes in the package of a moisturizer with sunscreen in it or as a sunscreen that can be hydrating or moisturizing.
Well, Dr. Bodimer, we've learned a lot. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
Dr. Apple Bodimer is an integrative dermatologist. She is assistant professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. She also directs an integrative dermatology clinic, which focuses on offering this healthcare approach for dermatologic conditions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show. Get your moisturizer. You're listening to the Ideas Network.